It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. You're about to learn about the risks and benefits of taking psychedelic drugs in tiny doses. That's the latest book topic from best-selling author Michael Pollan. But first, Seattle's mayor, Jenny Durkin, is on the phone live. Mayor, thanks for making the time.
Thanks so much for having me. For a minute, I thought that psychedelic drug introduction was about me.
We'll see how much time we have to get into that with you. But I know I want to ask you about the next police chief. And first, I want to ask you about homelessness. The annual snapshot of homelessness in Seattle and King County is just out. The numbers are being released at a news conference happening right now. Bottom line, there are more people in that situation than last year, a 4% increase. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a combination of factors that we've seen in this region, but the number one driver is lack of affordability. Housing prices are so high, and we've seen that with every $100 increase in rent, more people fall into homelessness. We also know that there is about five factors that contribute to homelessness, including our criminal justice system, our foster care system. So if we can get upstream to the root causes of homelessness, I think we will start to make a real difference. And even though the numbers have increased, there's some real glimmers of hope in the data. The first is that the rate is slowing and some of our efforts are working. Second is the number of veterans and veteran families have been reduced significantly. And that is the result of a region-wide push to really focus on veteran homelessness. So it shows us that when we have strategies that are focused on a particular population and its needs, we can start to have an impact.
Mayor, as you know, Mayor, the Chamber of Commerce says, quote, this was 2 months ago, an op-ed in the Seattle Times, and we've talked to them too, quote, the city's approach to homelessness is not working. You can see it in our neighborhoods, on our streets and sidewalks, and in the annual data from the one-night count. And that was written before this latest report that shows, as you say, a slower increase, but an increase. Is that fair? Do you agree the city's approach to homelessness is not working?
I think it's not working well enough, fast enough, but we have started to make some difference. And yesterday I announced something, one part of our strategy, a plan that I think will start to make a difference in neighborhoods. We're going to move 500 people out of cars, off the streets, out of tents, into safer places where we can get them the services that they need. And in doing that, we'll see, I hope, a marked difference both in how our city looks and feels, but also able to give the services to the people experiencing homelessness they need to get more stability and then long-term housing.
And so, Mayor,
I
understand that expenditure is coming from a one-time property sale. So how many more properties does Seattle have lying around that can be sold to pay more for homelessness services?
We're going to show that these are effective services, and at the same time, the city has put in place for the first time metrics and requirements for service providers to meet to show that they're working. And if we continue to have efficiencies in the system, we will be able to move more people into long-term housing and I think prove to the citizens what money we need and what additional revenues we need. I have not heard from anyone in this city that they're not willing to do more to help people. They just want to know that it works and it's needed.
Yes.
We as a city have to prove that it's needed and that we're using the money efficiently.
That's right. And the money, for example, Carolyn Adolph, our reporter at KOW, reported to us that in 2013, the general fund of the city started ramping up from $800 million then to $1.1 billion now. That's 30% growth. What do you say to someone who looks at not only today's new numbers of the one-night homeless person count, but the tents and the RVs, et cetera, and says, look, Talk is cheap. Fighting homelessness is not cheap, and it's still not working.
It's not cheap, but I hope that it will start working better. And we in Seattle cannot do it alone. It's why the regional solution and the one table process is so important. If you look at the numbers, Seattle is shouldering a significant amount of this burden alone. I mean, over 70% of the people experiencing homelessness who are unsheltered end up on the Seattle streets. We need to make sure that we have strategies to both deal with people in the communities where they become homeless, but also make sure that King County, cities in the region, and the state start doing more, not just on the homeless problem, but start funding behavioral health. We all know that mental health and opiate addiction and other chemical substance abuse problems are a contributing factor to homelessness and our ability to solve this issue. Those are state responsibilities that have been severely defunded. We'll continue to work with the state legislature and others. In the meantime, we're going to make a difference on what's happening in Seattle as best as we can.
We're talking yesterday's
a start. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Bill.
That's okay. Yesterday's a start. Yes, that you're referring to the plan that you unveiled, increasing the number of bridge housing and shelter units in the next 3 months by 25%. We are in an emergency. Last question on homelessness, Mayor. A city declared emergency before your time, but are in an emergency, declared emergency situation, are there dramatic executive actions you could take? Politics and public opinion be damned?
I think yesterday was the first start of that. I think the increase of our shelter capacity by 25% is the most significant increase that's ever been done. It will need city council approval. They have indicated they're willing to do it. But this plan, really, to bring people inside is going to start helping us give them the services, and we'll see a difference on the streets. Right now, I spent yesterday morning at 7:30 in the morning. I started with the navigation team. And one of the problems they have is they engage with people, but they have nowhere to refer them. Our shelters have been 93% full. So we need more space to bring people out of tents, out of RVs, off the street. And if we can do that, get them the services, and at the same time increase the amount of affordable housing we have, make sure the state and the county pick up the tab on behavioral health, and really start making the difference in people's lives, I think we can really make a difference. It's not going to happen overnight, and I won't pretend that it's going to happen overnight, and there's no one silver bullet, but if we're smart and more strategic and work together, I think we can really make a difference.
Talking with Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin live on KUOW. Mayor, you've heard the criticism the past few days over Interim Police Chief Carmen Best not getting the job, not being a finalist. Here is Harriet Walden with Mothers for Police Accountability earlier this week.
We lay this at the feet of the mayor. We took 97-some years to get a female mayor, and the first thing she does is crush another female.
A female, an African-American woman leading the police chief. She's been doing the job. She's, from all accounts, well-liked. Are you surprised to hear such community anger, the idea of you hear betrayal in Harriet Walden's voice?
Carmen Best is a terrific person and has been invaluable to me as mayor, as interim chief. I selected her as chief because I had a tremendous amount of confidence in her. I've known her for years. And I have asked her to stay on as chief because I have confidence in her. I've also asked her to stay on and help whoever the new chief is be successful, which she says she wants to do. And I think the most important voice in all of this with regard to that issue is the chief herself, who has said she wants to focus on the job of being chief. We have a lot of very important and difficult issues we're facing in Seattle regarding policing right now. And that's where the chief and I are spending our time and our energies. At the same time, I completely understand the relationship between community and police, and I've worked in that area for decades. And I understand, particularly in communities of color, needing and wanting to have trust in the police and in the system. We set up a selection process that we wanted to be fair and transparent and to have as much involvement as possible. I think if you look at the end of the day, when people examine both the search committee and the examination process, we had a large participation from communities of color, policing experts, people from throughout this city. I think that the process was one that was a strong process and gave us five good names to start. And those names, because the charter requires it, were reduced to three names based upon a whole range of factors. And none of that says anything about, you know, whether the two excellent candidates who weren't on the final list of three were excellent candidates, because they were. It's a really competitive thing to become a major city chief of police. And if you look at the searches that happen nationwide, you'll see that there are many more candidates who apply internally and externally than make it on the list. And that says nothing about the qualifications and how good a person that Carmen Best is because she is.
Final question for Mayor Jenny Durkan. The group No Tax on Jobs is collecting signatures to put the new employee head tax on the November ballot for possible repeal. Amazon, Starbucks, Vulcan, Washington Food Industry Association trying to repeal. What would you do about affordability and homelessness services if that tax were repealed this fall?
We are going to continue forward in progress and not be distracted by the politics of the referendum. It's really important, I think, that the city see that we can govern, we can move forward together as a city. I will be working with people on every front to make a difference on both affordability and homelessness. At the end of the day, I hope that people are able to lower the temperature on that and we can come together and work on the things we are all for. But my job as mayor is to continue to move forward to deliver what the people of the city expect us to deliver.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan joining us live on KUOW, and we really appreciate it. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW. Coming up, how to change your mind, the benefits and risks of psychedelic drugs. Stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. There are a lot of ways to change your mind. You can learn a new piece of information, a fact you didn't know. You can have a new experience. Traveling abroad can change your mind. Falling in love can change your mind. In a way, when I drink a cup of coffee, I'm changing my mind into one that's more alert. But one kind of mind-altering action that's taboo is hallucinogenic drugs. And my next guest wants you to rethink that. Journalist Michael Pollan has taught us a lot about the food we put into our bodies. His new book is about the psychedelics that you could, not legally, put into your body. The book is called How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Michael Pollan, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be here.
I just ticked off ways to change my mind, and they're all legal. Why would I want to change my mind with something illegal?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, it's not always illegal. There are now drug trials going on at very reputable institutions like Johns Hopkins and NYU and UCLA, Harbor Medical Center, where actually they are administering psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, to volunteers in a series of studies. So there is a legal way to do it. But it is also commonly done illegally. You know, in your state, probably more than just about anywhere, because so many psilocybin mushrooms grow there.
You went looking for mushrooms on the Pacific coast, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Well, Paul Stamets, who's a world-renowned mycologist, who lives in Washington State, took me hunting for psilocybe azurescens, which is the most potent of all psilocybes on the coast. And it was a really interesting experience. And it's remarkable that a mushroom produces a molecule that can have such a profound effect on the human brain.
What is that effect on your brain, Michael? Well, what was your experience? I know you have more than one, but give us a sense.
Well, the experience at a high dose, when you're having a guided psychedelic session, and it's important for listeners to understand, this is not taking a handful of mushrooms and going to a concert. This is a very carefully controlled situation with a therapist in attendance who is preparing you for the experience, accompanying you during the journey. You're lying down, you've got headphones on, you're listening to a very carefully curated playlist of music, and you're wearing eye shades, and that encourages a very internal trip. And then after, this guide or therapist helps you integrate what you saw. So when you do a high-dose psilocybin session under those circumstances, what often happens is the complete dissolution of your sense of ego or self. And that's a very profound and can be a very destabilizing or ecstatic experience, depending on how you approach it.
Well, assuming that the ego is there for some reason, is there a danger in breaking down that wall?
Yeah, well, the ego probably is very adaptive. Look, the ego, got my book written. It helps us navigate life.
You were the same Michael Pollan when you started as when you finished, according to your ego. You have that stable sense of self and consciousness.
Yeah, that's one of the things the ego gives us, is this sense of being continuous over time. It may be an illusion. You know, the Buddhists think it's an illusion, and you certainly come out of this experience wondering if that might be true. But the ego also can be very punishing. Mental illnesses like depression, anxiety, addiction may be the result of a hyperactive ego that is, getting us stuck in very unproductive stories, like, I'm the kind of person who can't get through the next hour without a cigarette, or I'm unworthy of love. We get trapped in stories that our egos tell, and they're not always helpful. The ego also is kind of a patrolman or woman who patrols the borders between ourselves and other people, and ourself and our subconscious feelings, and prevents a lot of information and sometimes experiences like love from getting in. So having a temporary reprieve from the rule of the ego can actually be mind-changing.
Can that temporary loss of ego have risks to it?
There's no question that psychedelic drugs have risks. Most of the risks are psychological. People who don't have very stable egos, shouldn't probably be messing around with them. People at risk for serious mental disorders, such as schizophrenia, are screened out of these experiments routinely. It's not helpful to people with serious mental illness. And people do have so-called bad trips, which look like psychotic episodes to your average doctor. In fact, are probably just panic attacks that subside after a while, especially if the doctor knows how to talk to you about it. Without question, there have been people who have had psychotic breaks on psychedelics. However, it's important to understand that they're safer than a lot of drugs we use routinely. The stigma of how scary they are is really a legacy of this moral panic that took place in the 60s when we were told that LSD scrambled your chromosomes or encouraged you to look at the sun till you went blind. This was not true. From a physiological point of view, in terms of your body, they're actually relatively non-toxic and they're non-addictive drugs. So they're not drugs of abuse the way, say, opiates are, or methamphetamine, or any number of other drugs. So that's not to give them a completely clean bill of health. There are people who should approach them with great caution, and they are, for the most part, illegal, and that needs to be factored in as well.
This is journalist Michael Pollan, author of the new book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Here's a skeptic, Michael. We ask KOW listeners what it's like to be on a little LSD, and we got this call.
Hi, this is Steve calling from Squim, Washington, and it's kind of even hard to deal with the question. Since the drug is totally illegal, the only way you can source the drug is to get it on the black market or on the street, whatever. And therefore, you have no idea what the dosage is that you're getting. And, if you divide it up into what you think is a micro amount, you don't know what that is, if indeed it is a micro amount. You don't even know what it is that you're actually getting. So, it's impossible to do microdosing unless you're part of some very small scientific study that's gone through the Byzantine permitting process through the government to be able to participate in something like this. So kind of a hard question to ask, much less answer.
Michael Pollan, if you're not in one of those government studies, is the lesson you don't know what you're doing. Don't try to microdose a psychedelic drug.
Well, that is the problem with prohibition, right? When you prohibit something completely, you can't regulate it. You can't have standards of dosage. You can't have standards of quality. And that is an argument many drug policy reformers make for legalizing drugs, that it allows you to control them to a much greater extent than you can when they're illegal, ironically enough. The caller is really talking about microdosing, and that's a very specific practice of using tiny amounts of LSD or psilocybin on every couple of days. It's an amount beneath the threshold that you would feel in any kind of dramatic way. You're not tripping. And this has become a very popular practice, especially in the tech community and where I live in the Bay Area. The thing about it is, though, we don't really know if it works. And it's important for listeners to know that the science has not been done on microdosing. It may be happening soon, but so far everything we know about it is strictly anecdotal. And people do report that it helps relieve their depression, that it increases their focus and their creativity, but that all may be placebo effect. The focus of how to change your mind is really on macrodosing. It's on using large doses to induce what's sometimes called a mystical experience or a dissolution of ego that creates a kind of reboot for a brain that is stuck in unhelpful habits of thought and behavior. Whether you're mentally ill or just kind of getting old and rigid, they lubricate cognition. Microdosing is a different story. It's a really interesting story, and I'm eager to follow it. But since there was no science to follow yet, I didn't give it as much attention in my book as I did to these trials with larger doses of psilocybin.
KUOW listeners, I wonder whether you are persuaded, intrigued, repelled by what we're talking about with journalist Michael Pollan, the benefits of lubricating your cognition, as he says, with the psychedelic drugs. So our phone number is 206-543-5869, 206-543-5869. Ask a question or tell us your story. Tweet at us, at KUOW. We're live tweeting this program. So, Michael, if the mystery, the risk, the illegality of psychedelic drugs is daunting, you're talking about lubricating your cognition. Are there other ways, legal ways, that you might recommend instead
Absolutely.
To a listener?
Absolutely. Many of the effects, positive effects of psychedelics on the mind can be achieved through other practices that are legal and non-pharmacological. Meditation, for example. One of the more curious findings of the new science of psychedelics is that the mind of a very experienced meditator, when scanned with an fMRI brain scan, looks very similar to someone who is tripping on psilocybin or LSD. The same brain networks are depressed or suppressed, and you have this sense of a loss of self and followed by emerging into some larger entity, whether it's other people or nature or the divine. And meditators achieve that same sort of selflessness. And in fact, it's a goal of meditation. And it is, you know, why the Buddhists say that the self is an illusion, because you can transcend it during meditation. But meditation is hard work, and not everyone can do it well. And psilocybin is kind of a shortcut. Some think of it as cheating, but it takes you to a very similar place. And one of the things I was struck by after I had my guided psychedelic experiences is that it vastly improved my meditation. I was much more effective at quieting my mind. And I think that is because of the experiences I had. Many of the American Buddhists, the famous American Buddhists who brought Buddhism to the mainstream in America beginning in the 70s and 80s, they began with psychedelics and then were looking for a non-pharmacological way to sustain that very helpful mode of consciousness.
That's an interesting point. Is there anything new about your book? Are you telling us anything we haven't known for since the 60s and thousands of years ago?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, some of the science, the findings of the very latest brain science are supporting things that Hindi and Buddhist scholars from thousands of years ago were saying about the self and the illusory nature of the self. But in our culture, it's not true until science tells you it's true, mm-hmm. for better or worse. And the science is very new. The science of psychedelics, you know, stopped after the 60s. There was such a moral panic against the drugs that scientists who'd been working very productively with them all through the 1950s, developing interesting strategies to help people deal with addiction and depression and anxiety, had to stop. And so we lost 30 years of research. That research has resumed, and it is telling us very important things about addiction, about depression and anxiety, and what all those illnesses perhaps have in common. And it's also telling us things about how the mind works and how consciousness works and what the ego is and the fact that it's not the only way. You're not identical to your ego, and you don't have to identify with it as completely as most of us do.
Michael Pollan's new book is called How to Change Your Mind. It's about the new science of psychedelics. And we have a phone call from John from West Seattle. John, I understand you use psilocybin?
Yes. How are you? Thank you, Mr. Pollan. We're big fans of Thoughts and Desire. Really glad that you branched out into having this discussion as well.
We're having a little trouble hearing you, John. I don't know whether you're going to hang on the radio or not. Do you have a question or a story to relate?
Is that better?
Yeah, that's better. What's your psilocybin experience?
Yes, we live in Seattle, in West Seattle, and this area is famous for the Blue Ringers or the science that grows, the psilocybin that grows here. So we have cultivated or gathered and then microdosed psilocybin for about 3 months earlier this year. And my husband was able to cut back on his Wellbutrin by 50%.
He cut back on his Wellbutrin
by 50%.
Yeah.
And we both, experienced, no psychotropic effect as far as tripping, but did feel a little bit sharper, a little bit more alert during the day. So that's one, two-person case study, but we do want to thank Mr. Pollan for leading the discussion, so thank you.
John, thanks a lot for calling in. Michael Pollan, he thanked you in the beginning for your past work, and we know you best, of course, for writing about the food that we eat. And you've passed on advice like don't eat anything that you can't pronounce. I'm going to try this.
Or that your grandmother would not recognize as food.
Food, yeah. So I don't know. I had to look up both the pronouncer and question myself about my grandmother when it comes to lysergic acid diethylamide. So how does that square with your natural food advice?
Well, it's not food. I think that's important to understand.
But I'm putting it in my body and it's affecting me. To me, it's food. That's how I start thinking about it.
It's another thing that nature produces that we take into our body that transforms us. And that's kind of the basis of my interest in it. We use nature, these other plants and these mushrooms, for food, for beauty, for sweetness, these desires that they gratify. But we also use nature, and as your introduction stated so eloquently, to change consciousness. All of us have used a plant probably today to change consciousness. Coffee, tea, a cigarette, chocolate. These are all mind-changing substances to one degree or another. And that's a very curious human desire, and it appears to be universal. There's not a society on Earth, with one exception, that doesn't use a plant or fungus to change consciousness. And the exception is the Inuit, the Eskimos. And the only reason they don't is nothing good grows where they live. I've always been interested in that desire. And, I do think we have to be very careful what we put in our bodies. And in fact, I was really quite reluctant to try one of these drugs. I hadn't used them when I was younger and did a lot of research to explore the risks, both bodily and mental risks involved, and satisfied myself that in the company of a guide that I trusted, this was a safe thing to do and that would actually offer more benefit than risk. But everybody has to make that calculation themselves. I'm not recommending anybody do this. What I am recommending is that we allow the science to proceed, support the science, and let them figure out if indeed this is a powerful tool to help with mental health treatment. Right now, the mental health treatment world in America is really in trouble. There are so many people suffering from depression, especially. Rates of depression are up. Rates of suicide are up. And we just don't have great tools. The antidepressants that we have, which really represent the last important innovation in mental health treatment, aren't working that well for many people. They don't like, as your caller said, they're eager to get off them. and they're hard to get off, and they have side effects people don't like. So that if there is indeed a tool that would allow you to have a single life-changing, mind-changing experience, not a pill you take every day, a pill that's not toxic, and I'm talking about psilocybin here, that would be an enormous benefit to lots of people and stands to relieve a great deal of suffering. So even with our skepticism and our concerns about these drugs, which we should always have, I think we'd be making a mistake to turn our backs on this potential revolution in mental health treatment.
We're helping you calculate benefits and risks of psychedelic drugs with journalist Michael Pollan. We have some feedback from listeners. A Twitter user with the handle Seattle Eyes says, "I wish I'd had the option to try psychedelic therapy as marriage counseling. That might have been the jolt we needed to reconnect at a heart level." And we also have a caller on the line, Diane from Wallingford. Diane, what is your psychedelic experience?
Yeah, so I was really excited to hear Michael Pollan on your show. I just bought his book, and I've been reading it, partly because I usually intentionally take a macro-dosed trip or two or even three a year. And I find it does exactly what he says about lubricating your brain. It makes you more emotionally connected to everyone around you. And those effects are long-term, not just while you're on the trip or immediately afterwards. And I'm a very successful professional, well-regarded in my field, and I know a lot of people who feel the same way.
Michael, from your research, would you agree with Diane that the emotional connection that one might feel during a trip does have long-term post-trip consequences, sustained consequences?
It certainly did in my experience. I mean, one of the common things people report is this kind of overwhelming flood of love for the people in their lives, for people in general. And it's, you know, it sounds cliche. It sounds like a platitude. You feel like you're talking like a Hallmark card. But under the influence of these drugs, it feels like a deeply held, revealed truth of the universe that love is the most important thing. And one of the curious aspects of the insights you have on psychedelics is that they're particularly sticky. If you conclude during a psychedelic trip that, hey, smoking, really stupid way to, you know, kill yourself, that thought, which you might think is pretty banal and obvious, becomes like a tablet that you've brought down from the mountain, and you can act on it. So that is the sense in which, yeah, those kind of insights can be enduring.
Diane, we're going to take a break in a moment, but just very briefly, would you recommend psychedelic psilocybin or what have you to, let's say, your child?
Well, that's a complicated question. My child is, I have two children. They're both under the age of 13, so I wouldn't recommend it to them. And for me, it was something that I experimented with in college and found that I liked it and always felt safe while doing it. So I would recommend to them that if they were curious, it would be something that I would support them experimenting with when they're older.
Diane, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
On KOW, we're talking with journalist Michael Pollan. And again, his new book is How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. And I have so many more questions for you. Would you mind hanging on for a short break and coming back and talking more, Michael?
I'd be happy to.
Michael Pollan, more coming back in just a moment on The Record.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees.
You may know Michael Pollan best as writing about food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and more. His latest book is called How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. And we're listening to you. Our phone number is 206-543-5869. We've heard from a skeptic. We've heard from a couple fans of psilocybin. We're again at 206-543-5869. If you have a question or an experience, in fact, we got a question from Jenny who says, "I personally have never done acid/LSD, but I've heard of awkwardness on acid with other people and the uncomfortable feeling. How do you handle that, and is that common, Michael?"
Well, people can have really negative experiences. You know, one of the most unusual things about these drugs is how susceptible the experience is to your set and setting, by which we mean the mindset that you go into the experience with and the physical setting in which it takes place. And if you're not in a place where you feel safe, you could really run into trouble. Because essentially what's happening is your normal defenses are down, either lowered or eliminated. So you're very vulnerable to whatever is coming in, and everything is being amplified in this intense way. So if you're in an anxiety-provoking situation where you don't feel safe, you could have a really unhappy experience. And that's why it's an experience that you go into with your eyes open and with a recognition that perhaps you need help, you need a guide. The guides help people to surrender to the experience, which I think is one of the most important things to do. They tell you, quoting the Beatles, actually, relax your mind and float downstream. Don't resist what's happening to you. If you see a staircase, climb up it. If you see a door, open it. If you see a monster, don't run away. Go right up to it. And that kind of advice, and this is in the trials that I was describing at Johns Hopkins and NYU, that kind of advice really allows you to make full benefit of the experience because you're not resisting it. And resistance is really, I think, at the core of that feeling of uncomfortableness or even that bad trip.
We have a call from Bob, who is in Everett, and we were talking earlier, Bob, about non-psychedelic, non-drug approaches to, as Michael said, lubricating our cognition. And one of the things we talked about was meditation, which I understand, Bob, you have some experience in.
Yes, I do. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Believe it or not, this is the first time I've ever called a radio in 67 years of life.
Welcome. We're talking about new experiences today.
Yeah, I know. So, Michael, thank you for the contribution you're making, and I can feel and understand where you're coming from and the goodness that you're trying to achieve. I have to identify myself. I've been a meditator myself for over 40 years. I've been a Buddhist practitioner and teacher, and I've trained with a teacher for the last 25 years. So I might tend to come off a bit conventional from that perspective. But my only comment, Michael, is that I wouldn't want the message that you're communicating to appear incomplete because there wasn't enough information coming from what happens when the mind actually changes in a more permanent fashion. Because I noticed that you were saying during these experiences, and I've had these experiences myself with drugs many, many years ago, but the ego restores itself and the consciousness restores back to where it was and the self mm-hmm. reassembles itself, which in fact it does. My only comment, Michael, is to remind people that, yes, that happens along the way, but as we begin to see the body more as a temple, we begin to see the things, not just the food, which you're an expert in, but the drugs, as things which can create certain toxic aspects to our continuing practice, our continuing growth in specifically in meditation, which is my experience.
Bob, I'd like to let Michael respond to that. It's a good point. So, Michael, what do you have to say to Bob's concern?
Well, I think that's that's an important Buddhist principle, that you're not to take intoxicants, as it's usually translated. I'm not sure that's exactly the right word, into your body. And that's one of the reasons that many of the American Buddhists who began with psychedelics gave them up. And they were looking for a more permanent approach, a practice that they could do not just once or twice a year on psychedelics, but every day, and to find their way to that selfless form of consciousness without the help of a drug, and that many of them viewed the drug as a as a crutch, and that it was a crutch that at a certain point they were ready to throw away. And I totally get that. And I do think it's important for people to understand. But whether it's cheating, and that's kind of the subtext of you know, this kind of approach, to use a drug to achieve a change in consciousness as opposed to, say, a meditation practice or breathing exercises, which also can change consciousness and put you into a trance. I explored that in the book as well. You know, it may be, Aldous Huxley wrote about this in The Doors of Perception, it may be that all mental experience is mediated by chemicals in the brain, including meditation. Meditation may be physically turning off the default mode network. That's the network in the brain that is downregulated on psychedelics. And by the way, it's downregulated on during meditation. We've imaged the brains of meditators as experienced as your callers. And their brains look a lot like the brains of people on psilocybin, which is very interesting. So the fact that is, does it matter that that the drug comes from within your body, it's endogenous, or from a mushroom that grows in nature? There have been cultures who felt that that was not cheating, but in fact that was a beautiful thing, that that something in nature could actually change the contents of your mind. So I think that that's a cultural perspective, you know, as to whether the outside chemical produced by nature is less value than the internal chemical.
What about the synthesized compound of LSD?
Yeah, LSD is a different case than psilocybin because it is a man-made chemical.
Does it matter?
I don't know that it does. I think we tend to overestimate the importance of the synthetic versus the natural, and most chemists would say there's fundamentally not a difference. LSD is derived, however, from a fungus also, ergot, although it was tweaked by the chemist who discovered it. So it's not the exact version found in nature. But nature does produce a remarkable number of psychedelic substances, and I think that that's it's a mystery that we haven't yet unpacked. You know, what's in it for those fungi to have this effect on our minds?
You might be surprised to hear journalist, food writer Michael Pollan downplying the difference, the important difference between synthetic and natural.
Yes, I know.
Yes. What we're talking about his new book, How to Change Your Mind. And we have a call from Brendan, who's in Edgewood. Brendan, what's your story or your question for Michael and the rest of us?
I'm glad to hear this discussion. I attended a lecture at the National Institutes of Health about 15 years ago on plant hallucinogens. And one of the scientists there recounted instances where people, Native Americans whose lives had been destroyed by alcohol, would take peyote. And then after their hallucinogenic experiences, completely stopped consuming alcohol and could resume ostensibly normal life thereafter.
What do you conclude from that, Brendan? Yeah, it sounds like, Michael, you wanted to react.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that, you know, that experience that peyote was used commonly and is, and by the way, is another case where you can use these drugs legally if you're a member of the Native American Church and several other churches where psychedelics are regarded as a sacrament. But the fact is that alcoholism is a scourge among Native Americans, and this has been the one of the most successful treatments is using peyote, which is it's a cactus, and it's the source of the drug mescaline. And that is really what inspired the researchers who started using LSD in the 50s to treat alcoholism as well. And they had some success too. But look, these chemicals like this, plant hallucinogens, have been used in healing by a great many different cultures. We sort of think of psychedelics as beginning in the 1960s, and that's a mistake. The 60s is when they became famous in the West. But long before that, you had indigenous peoples in Mexico using psilocybin. Other mushrooms in the Old World have been used in healing. Even the ancient Greeks, you know, all those great names you've heard of from ancient Greek society participated in what is believed to be a psychedelic ritual once a year, the Eleusinian Mysteries, where everybody consumed something called the Kikion, which was, we don't know what the recipe was, but it allowed everyone on that one day, once a year, to have visions of the afterlife, to travel to the underworld, and to meet ancestors. And this shaped Greek society and culture in very important ways. And the lesson to take away from that is that the container, the cultural container in which we put these drugs is very important. That in traditional societies and in the Native American use, it's always part of a ritual, a ceremony. They're always elders. They're guides. And I think the problems we got into in America is the fact that when these molecules burst upon the West, beginning in the 50s and 60s, we didn't have a cultural context to put them in. So people used them often in a very careless way. And as a result, some people, not everyone, but some people had really negative experiences. So I think going forward, that's a very important cultural project, is like what's our equivalent of the ceremony or ritual in which the Native American church uses mescaline? Is it the doctor's office? Is it something yet to be invented? But I think until we have that right, it's very important to recognize the power and the psychological risks that attend these amazing molecules.
Brendan, do you have a story of your own experience with hallucinogens?
I did experiment in college. I do know that it's in a different chemical class. Ketamine has had significant success treating depression that has been refractory to our standard pharmacopoeia. And I've had my life kind of like halted or stopped by depression, and having experienced it, you'd much rather have a hallucinogenic experience that takes you away from depression than to have a sustained experience of depression.
Yes, Brendan.
I think that's a very important point. And ketamine is a legal drug. It is not exactly a psychedelic, but it produces a psychedelic experience in people, and is being used right now to treat depression with very impressive results. But yeah, there's risks of not in some people of not using these drugs, and of course the risk of depression is suicide, and it's a very serious risk.
Brendan, thank you for calling. I want to make time for another caller. Andrew from Tacoma, what's your experience or your question for Michael Pollan?
Well, I just want to affirm everything that I've heard Michael Pollan say, and especially the piece about not having ritual. I think that is one of the pieces that is really missing in our society. When I was in college, like many people, I experimented with psychedelics, and they brought me to that real sense of oneness and unity, that realization that ego is a myth, it's a lie that we tell ourselves, and coming back out of the psychedelic experience and having my ego reassembled, I've never forgotten that. And even though I haven't used psychedelics in well over a decade, I would feel like that has been the foundation of my Christian faith, is this realization that ultimately our goal is to find unity and oneness with God, and our ego is often the thing that gets in our way, that desire to perform or appear the facade, what John calls the world or what Paul calls the flesh. And so it's been foundational for me in my faith walk, and also want to affirm what I've heard the Buddhists say, which is we need to have those experiences so that they can be those kind of mountaintop experiences that align the rest of our lives rather than being things that we depend on the chemical substance for. I think that they are windows to a new way of being that we should aspire to find and be oriented towards in our daily living rather than being dependent on psychotropic drugs to get us there.
Andrew, I really appreciate that phone call and perspective. Thank you for that. We just have two more minutes with Michael Pollan, and I have two more questions. Have you had any businesses hire you to tell them how psychedelics can make workers more productive? Because I'm expecting it. You said it's a thing in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley who are I just want to just say something about that last caller's, just his eloquence, and I really appreciated what he had to say.
Me too.
But going back to your question, no, and that's not a proper role for a journalist. I don't consult with anybody.
Okay.
Microdosing
Fridays is not
coming.
It's coming, or it's here.
It's here, actually, in certain companies. At least that's what I hear about. And other companies who are using psychedelics in their management training, believe it or not. You know, if you
and if it's in Silicon Valley, it's in Seattle. We just don't talk about it as much as you.
Well,
guys
I think that's right. You are Silicon Valley North.
Yeah,
and I spoke at Google in Seattle last week, and I started my talk by saying I'd like to welcome the Google Microdosing Club to today's event, and there was a pretty a knowing laugh when I said that.
Uh huh. Yeah. Okay. Finally, what'll be the first state to legalize psychedelic drugs?
I don't think it'll be a state. You know, Oregon wants to put it on the ballot, and there are people talking about doing that in California, and I'm not sure that's the right way to go. I think the right way to go is to continue down this path of FDA drug approval. Mm-hmm. And if the FDA is satisfied by the trials that are about to get started, these are large phase 3 trials of psilocybin for depression, the FDA will declare this is a medicine. And at that point, MDs will be able to prescribe it with certain restrictions. So I think that that will happen all at once, and it will happen nationally. And it will usher in a new age in psychotherapy that, you know, has a great deal of promise. But again, it has not been proven yet. These are still small studies, and they have to be replicated on a larger scale. But that will happen beginning later this year or early next year.
Journalist Michael Pollan, the book is How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Great comments and phone calls from you. And Michael, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle.